Well, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. It's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Hi, Mike.
And sounding as if she's in the studio, even though I know she's not here, Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hi, Mike and Terry. Good to be here.
Okay, so we have some things that have happened that have made a few people glad down in Juneau. We have had a series of events over the past week, though, that are very, very sad. And I thought maybe we could begin with the bear. We'll get to Juneau, but we have yet another bear death. And Zaz, you've been looking at the history of this thing and what's happening recently. How about a summary so we can make perhaps some sense of what's been going on?
Well, I wish we could make some sense of what's been going on, but unfortunately, in terms of what happened this week, it's Sunday and Monday, there were two very different people in very different settings mauled and apparently killed by black bear. And so, obviously, an incredibly painful situation, and not only for their families and their friends, but for, both really had... Aaron Johnson was our contractor working about 5 miles from Pogo Mine, who was killed by a black bear on Monday. And Jack Cooper was a 16-year-old runner from Anchorage who was killed defending Bird Ridge after a race on Sunday. And there is both of their deaths really sent a lot of ripples through a lot of communities. Their lives, she was, I think, 27 and he was 16. Were short, but had really, they touched a lot of people. And so, at newspapers, what we do is at some point take a step back and say, well, what's connecting this? What's going on here? What's the trend here? And I don't know that there is one, frankly. I think that because there was black bears involved in both of these deaths, it's very unusual. What we've all kind of learned is that statistically, if you're going to be killed by a bear, which, we should take another step back and say that statistically you're way more likely to be killed by almost anything else, even in Alaska. One of the mountain racers that was interviewed for a story this week said, it's more likely I'm going to die driving to a race, way more likely than I will at, in a bear attack. But given all that, one of the kind of statistics that I think most of us maybe weren't aware of was that overall bear versus bear, black bear, if they attack, tend to attack in a predatory fashion more often than brown bears do. Beyond that, these two attacks so close to each other, both of these victims, I think, were fairly small. I don't know if that factored into anything. They both, in one attack, pepper spray was used, and it didn't work. The can worked, and it sounds like it was deployed successfully, but the bear came back. That was the Pogo Mine incident. And we don't know exactly what happened with Jack Cooper because there was no one else there. I think the assumption is that he was trying to get away from the bear. At any rate, there's all kinds of armchair quarterbacking that could go on. I think that the mountain racing community is taking another look at races, but with the understanding that this is Alaska, there are bears in Alaska, and I think that we all go out there knowing that. The question is, to what level can we be prepared to avoid it? And it seems like pepper spray is the one thing that's come up quite a bit. I think that, unfortunately, the larger takeaway is you can never be 100% prepared. This stuff is going to happen, unfortunately, and it really, it's been a very dark week, I think, for a lot of people, and it's a combination of, it's really a kind of a grim, scary tragedy, but also one that taps into why most of us come or stay in Alaska, is that there is enough wild country that there's still bears here, and that's that kind of... There's a dark side to that as well, but because bears, like most wild country, are things you can't control.
So there, I'm curious, Zaz, do you know there are any other parts of the country that are having these same type of incidents, sort of with bears, or are we an anomaly?
I think the one connection there are some western states that still have bears. Mm-hmm. There are probably, and I haven't looked at the numbers here, but if there is, I don't know if there's an increase, but if it's happening elsewhere, it's because of the increase in mountain running.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot more people not only, you know, training and having fun running in the mountains, which is really fun, but doing more endurance races. So they're getting out further. They're maybe alone because you start with a fairly small field and then you all kind of scatter. So yeah, I know that there was one ultra runner. She was in a race in New Mexico who was, I believe, mauled by a black bear on a fairly, within the last few years. It doesn't happen as often, I don't think, just because we have more bears up here and in the front country. But yeah, it does happen in other states.
Yeah. More bears, more races, more conflict.
Yeah, and more people doing the
more
races
races.
Yeah, and running for fun.
Well, as I've listened to these stories recently, I'm reminded I had the pleasure of running a Crow Pass race more than once. And, of course, you start in down in Girdwood and go over the pass and over the river and through the woods to Eagle River. And every time there were black bear all along that trail that we were warned about in terms of race prep, et cetera. I'm thinking back and saying I never felt there was a problem with that. And listening to people who had encountered bear, they would either let them pass by or and this is the kind of race when even if you have 110 people running over 20 some odd miles, I was running by myself a good portion of that time. And I think that race and other races, the people putting them together are reconsidering now. You can go a long time and not have a problem, but all you have to do is have one, and it brings attention. And I think up at Pogo, as I understand what they've decided to do, is even though they had taken all kinds of preparation, they had trained people with firing canisters, bear spray, and so on, they're going to put a guard with each of those pairs rather than just let them be by themselves out there.
Well, I think there has to be a huge liability for people, not only, you know, organizers of these races now and also for the you know, the Pogo Mine folks of now that it's been identified as a problem, there's a liability there.
Well, let's
Although it's possible that at least that one bear that was killed by wildlife troopers was the problem. I mean, unless we're suddenly seeing more predatory black bears out there, which has not been determined.
Right. Okay. Well, let's swing our focus down toward Juneau. And just a reminder that all of the cities, whether it's Anchorage or Valdez or Juneau, have bear populations, and Juneau in particular has long dealt with the question of how to protect against attracting bear by making sure that whatever you put into trash is not going to be the next dinner for your resident neighborhood black bear. So that is an ongoing issue. But what is positive, I think a number of people felt positive about last night. This is Thursday night at in Juneau at the Capitol building. Was that there were two floor sessions. I had the I don't know what the pleasure for whatever reason sat down and watched, and I happened to catch it right at the time that those sessions started. First the Senate floor session and second the House floor session, both of which voted on the compromise that had come out of committee to pass an operating budget. And they were both relatively short. They were very focused sessions. They took under an hour, say, for each one. There was some drama, if you will, in the question of who would be voting no, although both houses had done the counting. So there wasn't a lot of suspense whether they would or wouldn't. There were people who stood up, and I think it's notable, since we're talking about Valley Edition, that all but one of the Valley delegation voted no, or absented themselves. So, for example, starting with the Senate, Michael Dunleavy was excused. He was not there. But, of course, Senator Wilkowski was also absent, interestingly enough. I'm not sure why both of them were, but they were. In the Senate, there was only one senator who voted no, and this was only to the first part. Each of these votes were taken in two parts. First of all, you did the budget, and then second, you did the fiscal note that went along with it. And Senator Shelley Hughes voted no to the budget, and then later on voted yes to the money that would be sent there. This was a very, very significant move on her part, and she asked the Senate president to speak and then spoke at some length about her concerns and the reason why she was voting no, recognizing, clearly stating, she recognized that by so doing, she was following a path that had been trod by Senator Dunleavy when he voted against a budget bill. And the way that caucus rule works, you take a pledge to vote yes to what they agree to. If you don't, you leave the caucus and probably also leave whatever office you have, et cetera, and become a outlier in the system. So later on, it was, I think, instructive to note that Senator Hughes, when the floor had their floor session, was seen sitting in the gallery while watching what was happening there. So we had a 17-1 vote in the Senate, basically, in favor of the budget. And over in the House, we had 31 to 8, I believe it was, with one excused. And as I pointed out, it was the Valley delegation in the House, plus Tammy Wilson from up Fairbanks, that said no. We had one member, let's see, you know, of, you know, you have to remember going back to the Senate, we had one Valley senator who voted yes to that budget, the new freshman senator.
David Wilson.
So that was the interesting thing. The substance of the vote, it's being reported widely, I think, is that the, very significantly, K-12 education was retained as a flat funding. There were a number of people that were happy with that. And of course, what had been revealed earlier was that there was going to be an additional $8 million, but this was short of a much larger cut for the university system. And a president, by the way, the president of the university was seen in the gallery as well. While that vote was going on, you could, viewing gavel to gavel, see the various people who were there. So the draw, of course, is coming out of the CBR, and a number of people spoke about why that was a better choice than the earnings reserve, and that's worth another discussion at another time. I think basically the governor has added a couple of other items to the call, and so they're not really done necessarily, but they're going to take a breath and a number of sighs now as they move forward, and whether there's anything at all that can be done that would address the greater issue of the long-term fiscal plan, that's still up in the air. And of course, there's a number of people that are observing and saying, if they do not do anything beyond what they have just done, this was likely to cause a reduction in our bond rating. That's a quick and summary they have there. Any comments or questions or other things? Terry?
Well, I think it puts our Valley delegation in a, certainly a different light. If you look back a couple of legislatures ago, they were sort of the powerhouse of the legislature. And now with this new turn of events, they have now have two of sitting senators that are out of any type of power to make any financial decisions. And it'll be interesting to see whether the caucus changes their mind about that rule or if who they put in that seat, who's next in line with Shelley who's losing her Senate finance seat. And they'll have to make those decisions too. I tuned into part of it. I think it's remarkable that after so much time, people have still so much more to say. It just kind of dragged on and on. And it's, you know, it's still a battle between ideology and, you know, those in there, the Dan Sadler's and some of those groups, Tammy Wilson, that there will never be enough cuts to make them really happy. But they, other than Tammy Wilson, sort of recognized the fact that the state was going to shut down in 8 days, and that would not only not be good for Alaskans, but it wouldn't be good for their political careers either. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Do you have any insight?
No, I'm wondering if the two of you, very close observers of this process, especially in the last 24 hours, have any insight into, I mean, the elephant in the room is the fiscal gap, mm-hmm. and how we close that, and how what is going to change between these two sides and the factions within each that will allow us to get to a point which is apparently, you know, the next step in the session, very special, extra special session. What is going to change? Is there leverage anymore? I mean, what's going to change to get them to a point where they can agree on whether it's earnings, some kind of plan for earnings on the permanent fund or something else, oil tax? What do you see changing given the personalities and dynamic you saw in Juneau?
I think sales tax, which Senator Hughes actually mentioned and seems to believe that her constituency is leaning more in favor of sales tax if you're going to go anywhere. I see an ideological gap that exists here where you have literally a chasm with a relatively small now group of people that are basically chanting cut, 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 more, more, more. And a group of people, both in terms of the coalition and just people that are willing to work on cuts and additional income at the same time. And I think, to me, that's the trick. If as Tammy Wilson explained, basically she had a certain goal for a reduction, and until that goal is reached, she didn't really want to hear anything else about money that involved taxes or other sources. And I think what will end up happening going forward is whether that relatively small number of people that are saying you have to cut until we reach, what, $4 billion or whatever the number is thrown out there, or we won't talk. If that's small enough where they're not impeding the process, then I think there may be some something. Senator Tom Begich did speak, I thought, pretty clearly by suggesting that everybody take a deep breath and then take a look at whether they can come back, and whether it's going to be later this summer or it's going to be next year, and deal with finding an item that they can accept to use for increased income. And I think that's going to be the interesting question as of this moment. I'm aware that they're going to continue to do some work this year, this summer. I don't know how long that's going to last and how much energy they have, or whether they're going to even be able to play off this positive note of at least having an operational budget.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say. Once the pressure for shutting down the government goes away, a lot of the noise they're hearing also goes away as people kind of settle into life as in usual. And so it's hard to believe that they'll be forced to really do anything, although they did start this two-year session off saying that they would deal with it next year, which was always hard for me to believe because guess what? It's an election year.
Yeah.
So,
but they have spent down the savings account, the congressional budget.
They have.
Basically gone.
They have. You know, and I think that's sort of what Governor Walker has been saying all along, is that they have to have a fiscal plan. I don't know that they pay that much attention to the credit ratings. And the fact of the matter is they don't have any money for capital projects. And that's when you worry about credit ratings, because you're trying to sell bonds and trying to get financing. So how all those impacts, they'll know by then, it would seem, how tax reform is going to go federally if that actually gets launched. Healthcare will have some impacts to the state. There may be even a bigger deficit there than, I mean, what they're talking about with health care could be pretty devastating to the state.
Well, the second half of, the second half of this legislature next year.
It's not going to get easier.
No, and this will be under the light of I'm running for reelection or not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, tight water. It's a tightrope walk for sure.
Okay, so let us now just turn in the, we have a small amount of time left. This past week we had a very interesting borough assembly meeting. There were a number of things discussed.
Let's talk about the port. Come on.
For people who out there, the borough is willing to talk taxes, and they'll be talking about taxes, a sales tax upcoming, but right now there's not much about that. The port. Terry.
No, I'm deferring to Zaz. She wrote a great article about it.
Okay. Zaz, let's go for it. What's going on there?
Honestly, what has happened is what we kind of thought would happen, but weren't entirely sure. But it was another $1.6 million is going to go to really this time fix the barge dock at Port McKenzie, the borough port. The borough port that's running at least $500,000 in the red every year, very little traffic. The barge dock had one barge call in 2016, partly because there were ongoing repairs for corrosion, which is a whole other problem. But the dock is constructed the same way the Port of Anchorage dock that was in the middle of a huge lawsuit was constructed. Port officials have told me several times that it's not the same problem, but you kind of wonder. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, there was a, when the dock was put in, the barge dock was put in 16 years ago, they hit a rock, and over time it split a big kind of a supporting seal Y that connects parts of the dock. And so they went in to fix that in 2016, and at least to hear Dan Mayfield, Assemblymember Mayfield, tell it, it hit part of the same rock formation, and so the fix didn't work. So now they're going back in with this $1.6 million, which is about $1 million in area-wide general funds and the rest from a ferry fund and a port enterprise fund to fix it for good this time. And, you know, the larger question is how much money do you pour into this dock and this port when you're getting negative back? And so, you know, George McKee, who is never afraid to speak his mind, he was the only vote against it. And, but several others, I'm holding my nose to do this. This is the last time I do this. But McKee just said, I'm not going to put any more money into this turkey.
Yeah, that was a great quote.
It was. And, you know, Jim Sykes, I think, was probably the closest to calling it a turkey and in a much more diplomatic way. But he said that he didn't want to support any more large infusions into the port without better marketing and vessel traffic there.
But he sounds like he also has asked some questions about what the costs are of mothballing it, and those are substantial.
And that's a whole different problem. And given the millions that they've poured into that dock, is it really a good idea to not at least preserve it in hopes that it'll start getting more traffic?
Who's doing all these repairs?
I don't know who's going to get the bid on this one. And there was a temporary repair for $500,000 that was done earlier this year. I don't have the story in front of me. The company escapes.
So is there a port director?
There is a retired port director who is apparently available to advise things. This is a piece of this puzzle I need to report more, because I believe there's a borough policy that once you retire from borough service, you can't work again for the borough for some time.
As a contractor?
Yeah, well, I think in any form, but I'm not entirely sure. Mark Van Dongen retired in April or May, and so is kind of waiting in the wings anyway, and the borough is not actively looking for another director at this point.
Okay.
Doesn't mean they won't be, but they are not.
So, if I were to drive out to the port, would there be anybody there?
Well, you can't get in anyway, even when Van Dongen was there, because it's gated.
There's a caretaker, isn't there, that...
Maybe.
But there is no public access. You can't just drive up to the port.
Not anymore. Oh.
Okay, so we can look at it. I can get into a boat and float by and take pictures of it, or I can even see it. I can see it from
Anchorage.
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of interesting. I was talking to someone about this the other day. That I mean, this port was sort of conceived, all that development land out there, when Dorothy Solomon was mayor.
Yeah.
It was odd, not by coincidence, a realtor that could see all the dollar signs of developing all that nice port land around there. And now he's gone, and I don't think anybody on the assembly was there during the decision to go down this road, this rabbit trail. Maybe Vern Halter probably was has been with them the longest, you know, having been in the Planning Commission, but most of them are sort of saddled with this as they were the ferry, this borough assembly. And which way do you go? And they finally made that decision on the ferry, and they seem to be better for it. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with this. This is an asset. So
I'm thinking of this as one leg of a three-legged stool. There was the bridge, the railroad, and the port. And the railroad is a little short-legged. The bridge has fallen off, and the port's the only thing that's trying to be balanced here, and that's a tough do.
Yeah, but isn't it still questionable, even if they finish the rail, if what commodities are really necessary?
Yeah. I mean, the rail backers and the port backers say that you really can't have a thriving port without that rail extension, and the borough has put out a lot of information about all the different commodities that could travel the rails. And that may be true. A lot of them were sort of speculative metals. But, you know, some of it is coal, and coal is so beholden to not only the price of coal and markets for coal, but the price of natural gas, which affects markets for coal, that it really is hard to say.
Okay. Well, someday, let's encourage, maybe you could be the person that does that, to make the proper connections and go out and walk out at the port and see what it feels like.
That's a great idea, Mike.
Go ahead, Mike.
Seriously, that would be, you know, with somebody and look around, because I think in many people's mind there's this image of port, and yet it's I'm not sure, but
you could go out and do a Facebook Live event out there. I don't know if you have connectability.
Okay, with that, I think we have come to an end of another edition of Valley Edition. I want to thank Zaz Hollander for calling in today. Thank you, Zaz.
Great to be here.
Right. And I want to thank Terry Snyder for coming into the studio. Thank you, Terry.
Have a good weekend.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Valley Edition.